Let's play a rebooted game. In honor of Jigsaw, what was the best film to come out of the Millennium Resurgence of both splatter horror or reboots?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Drag Me to Hell, which is one of my token horror films that I can actually handle. And I guess counts, right?
Sure. I'm David the Seven, and I'm going to say, finally, a reason to bring up that I was one of the people that liked feeling bad after watching a Serbian film.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I am going to go with Hostel, just because I think that movie does a really good job of making you wonder what you would do in that situation and how screwed you would probably be.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 186 and it's Tuesday, October 24th, the 116th anniversary of the day that Anna Taylor became the first woman to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel.
I enjoyed looking this one up.
Yeah, I don't know. I have never understood why that became a thing that people did, but I admire a human spirit, as always.
Indeed.
Speaking of the human spirit, we need you guys to gather yourselves together to leave us reviews. We still love having them. There will probably be more giveaways in the future. Matt Patches is not with us this week. He'll be back. He may come armed with Blu-rays. But there is a person who's tweeting at us that we missed their review. And David, there's a reason we haven't been able to find this person. What do we need for
them? Yes. Read in Actor Voice, or on Twitter, in Actor Voice, says, fairly sure my review from August of the podcast app itself never got read. I think he means on the podcast app. I'm not sure. But if Read an Actor Voice left us a review of iTunes, please let us know what your iTunes name is, and we'll go back into our archives and find it. We will also happily read your review if you leave us another one. If I don't actually know if one can do that. Or if anyone out there wants to leave us a review, there's a pretty high likelihood at this point that your review will be read on the next episode by me. What an honor to hear your name come out of my mouth. It's hard to imagine such a privilege, but it could be yours.
We continue to live to serve, so just keep bringing us those reviews and we will read them aloud.
It's the dream.
So, David, I heard a rumor that Todd Haynes has a new movie out. Can you confirm this?
I can, but only because I have been following this film for a while and been informed by various emails and press releases and whatnot that it's out. I certainly would not have known that had I just been following the internet or looking at movie advertisements. It's been snuck into theaters, but the rumors are, in fact, true. Todd Haynes of the Carol Haynes's is indeed back with a film called Wonderstruck, which premiered at Cannes, and I reviewed out of Cannes, which is why I think I'm part of the failure to give the film its proper due now that it's actually out for public consumption. Because we ran it through the gamut a few months ago. But yeah, Wonderstruck is indeed out right now. This movie is a lot more divisive than Carol was, but I thought, maybe predictably, that it was truly wonderful. But I was not always so high on Haynes. I mean, I think he's brilliant, and I don't think he's ever made anything that is not sort of send electricity through my brain, and I could feel the synapses connecting. But it wasn't really until Carol that there was any sort of emotional wallop to go along with the semiotics and the compositions and just the overall structure of his work, and how well-founded it is by his intellect. And so even something like Safe, which is obviously a much colder film, but I always sort of regarded it as brilliant but distant and Far From Heaven and so on. Carol really connected something for me, and Wonderstruck, which is adapted from Brian Selznick, who wrote Hugo, his like hybrid graphic. It's like a 600-page children's book, hardcover, that as two characters, and one of the characters, all of their story is told through these like charcoal illustrations, these pencil illustrations, with black and white, very sort of thick and textured illustrations, and the other half is told through prose. There was a reason for that. I guess we can get into it in a second. But the book is very digestible. It is meant for kids of a certain age, and it seems to be pretty far from Todd Haynes's typical wheelhouse. Haynes has worked from pre-existing material quite frequently, but he has never really made an adaptation that's as faithful. I mean, there are a number of scenes in Wonderstruck that, for which the Brian Selznick book and the illustrations therein could practically serve as storyboards for what Todd Haynes brought to the screen with Ed Lockman, his Carroll cinematographer. It's essentially the story. It's a bifurcated story about two kids, one growing up in 1927 and one in 1977, and they are both, at least eventually, deaf or partially deaf. The girl who's growing up in 1927 is completely deaf and was born deaf, I believe, and she wants to go on a trip to the city to find her mom, and who's a movie star, and she has an incredible adventure. It's shot all in black and white, like a silent film. I'm not saying in black and white like a silent film, but it's shot in black and white, comma, like a silent film.
As well as like a silent film.
And it has Carter Burwell just going nuts with this really beautiful flowing score on top of it. Looks fantastic. And then in 1977, Oakes Fegley of Pete's Dragon
fame.
What
a name!
Yep. well, the girl is played by a girl named Maleficent Simmons. So there are great names all up and down this place.
Wait, Maleficent or Millicent?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was terrible. Millicent.
She's not named for a Disney villain.
Yes. I have never met a Millicent or a Maleficent, so my brain just cheated towards Maleficent. But she is Millicent Simmons. She is actually deaf. And so in 1977... Portion, which is shot on 16mm film, I believe, if memory serves. Maybe not. I don't know. I think it is. I can't remember. It looks great. Whatever the case. His mom is Michelle Williams. He's struck by lightning. He is rendered mostly deaf, and he goes on a journey from the middle of America to New York City on a quest to find his family and connect some dots in his history. It's this sort of the story that's parallel story that's happening in these two timelines, and the ways in which they eventually intersect and overlap are obvious in a way, but also emotionally overwhelming. Particularly this is a very plot-driven movie, especially for Todd Haynes, which is not to say there aren't these really beautiful flowing sequences, particularly when the kids are exploring the Museum of Natural History, which plays a huge role in this movie, as does some of the exhibits that were left behind in Queens for the World's Fair. That's sort of where time is captured in a bottle, and the impact of one segment is manifest in the other. But the last 10 or 15 minutes of this movie in particular, when things sort of build to a head, are really, even if it's not a surprise necessarily, and there are only so many ways that this mystery could play out, are just so beautiful and pure that I found them immensely moving, and it's not subtle in a way that most Haynes films are, and it is obviously reaching for a younger audience, but it's not, I would say, necessarily, fully. This is not a kids' movie. It's about kids, and I think kids would enjoy it very much. But I think that it holds a similar place in Haynes' filmography as something like Moonrise Kingdom holds in Wes Anderson's. This one skews a little bit younger. It's a little bit less sarcastic and a lot less sexual than Moonrise Kingdom. But it is going after that same sort of vibe, in that the kids could enjoy it, but it's just as much for adults as any of the filmmaker's other works ever was. And it's
so
why, it did
yeah,
well.
why has it become such a kind of a non-entity?
I mean, it's too early to declare it dead on arrival, I think.
No.
But, it did decently for a, if this weren't a Todd Haynes movie that was tipped for all this glory, its numbers playing in four screens this weekend in New York and L.A. would have been commendable. But I think there was just, it didn't even do as well as The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And I think people just had high hopes for it. It could expand well. I think this will connect with audiences a lot more than Todd Haynes is used to. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that it just didn't really strike a nerve in the way that a lot of other breakout films recently have. It doesn't have any interest in the zeitgeist necessarily. It's very much its own thing. I think it's a kind of self-contained universe that is timeless, that people will be finding for many years to come. This is a movie that is as cinematic as it gets, but may ultimately do most of its living on smaller screens. I think it's something that he was able to do relatively quickly because so much of it existed before he even got there. And I think it's great that he did it. I mean, I think it's a really beautiful film, and I hope that it eventually finds its audience. The performances are wonderful. Julianne Moore, who plays a couple of roles in it, reuniting with Haynes from Safe and Far From Heaven days, is, brilliant in this. It's not as showy a performance as the previous stuff that she's done for him, but it's still really powerful. I would go into greater detail about what this movie meant to me, but I don't think that I should right now. But I don't know, there are other kids' movies you guys can think of that, other than maybe Moonrise Kingdom, that are not kids' movies, but are about kids, but that you engage with whatever age you watch them.
Dave, I wanted you to talk.
Oh, I mean, it's hard for me to, get out of recency bias because I watched a whole bunch of Stephen King stuff leading up to it. So obviously there's a whole bunch of that. There's, your Stand By Me's and your It's that I feel was echoed through a lot of adult fiction in my youth, but now that I'm thinking about it, if it's in my youth, it must have also been pitted at me. So I'm trying to think of a better movie than that.
I mean, one of the first things I thought of, and I don't think any of us are Beast of the Southern Wild super fans here, but the way that that movie tells stories about kids and kind of has the fantasy elements that kind of capture something about being a kid. It's weird because I'm a known anti-child actor person, so I have a hard time embracing kids as on screen and relating to them. But
maybe actually the fact that the Florida Project is sort of platforming right now at the same time, that's another movie that is about kids. I think it's a little bit more of the now, a little bit more exciting. And is similar. I mean, that is a much tougher movie. And actually, I was thinking, listening to you talk, Katie, a lot about the French New Wave and really French films in general, which have always been very strong on movies that are unambiguously geared towards adults, but that kids might find to be formative experiences that star kids. I mean, anything from The 400 Blows and Maurice Pialat and his films, to things like Zazie dans le métro, and then you can even go up to Sweden, where I think of Fanny and Alexander. I mean, there are, I think, a lot of classics of world cinema fall into this vein, but that American films, in much the same way as American animation, is we're only for kids. American films about kids, at least the studio films, are this is a kid's movie. And they don't really know what to do with those films that are in the in-between.
How about The White Ribbon, starring children as nuts?
Yeah. There you go. That's I'd say that is not a huge kids movie.
I don't think it was made for kids at all. But
it did not clean
kids
up at the Annie Awards.
I mean, it's funny that we're talking about this with Stranger Things about to come back, and we all have our own mixed feelings about Stranger Things too. But that's the current zeitgeist of it's about kids, but it's for you. I don't know. Do kids watch Stranger Things? I have no idea.
Oh, yeah. I got to imagine they watch Stranger Things.
But, elementary school kids? I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like there was, a whole, dangerous kids movie middle ground that existed in the late 80s and the early 90s that just, got washed out completely by, either, saccharine sweetness of, over-commercialization of, a Disney thing, or it had to have an angle or a texture. You were either Ice Age or you were Coraline, and nothing falls in between those things now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that those films were big in the 80s, and now the films that bring that back, the Stephen King's, your Stranger Things, not a film at all, are all just incredibly nostalgic for that time. So it feels rather than carve out this new space, films like The Florida Project and Wonderstruck are trying to do. Some of the bigger projects just tend to lapse back into, the time when they worked.
Yeah, and it's been a kind of notoriously bad year for movies specifically aimed at kids. Like, all the animated films have been pretty subpar. So maybe it's up to the It's and the Florida Projects and the Wonderstrucks of the world to do anything. Oh, I'm on Box Office Mojo, and there is a banner ad for Wonderstruck. So someone's advertising this movie.
Well, that's good.
Someone knows it's coming.
I didn't even remember that Despicable Me 3 came out this year. The segment can be over. I was just noticing that.
Wonderstruck is in theaters now. When it gets to your neck of the woods, if you don't live in New York and L.A., seek it out, especially if you liked Carol. it's worth a shot for sure. A great double bill with the Florida Project.
Tall and she grew up right with them Indiana boys on an Indiana night.
So I was sent a link by Not Here Matt Patches today to a Deadline story about how there are plans to launch a augmented reality experience called Movie Bill at your local Regal Entertainment Group in 2018. This will be like a playbill that you would get if you went to the theater, but themed for movies. And then if you opened your Regal Entertainment app, they have a AR reader that is going to allow them to embed things like additional behind-the-scenes content or trailers or interviews. So you get to walk into the theater, get this movie bill, which they are designing to be quote-unquote collectible, so probably at least semi-well constructed of like some sort of paper that isn't going to, you know, crumple when you spill your Coke on it. Sit down in the theater if you, you know, got there early enough. Oddly, whip out your phone. Ironically, you have to have it to use the Movie Bill AR app. And enjoy a little bit more content in the theater-going experience. I imagine this is the next, you know, step in trying to get the technology-driven generations back to the movie theater, despite it not necessarily catering to them with, I don't know, phone use and I don't know what people want these days out of movie theaters that aren't movies. But apparently, movies aren't good enough anymore. Is Movie Bill going to be good enough?
I mean, it's like, do you use your phone before the movie starts, but then the minute the movie starts, push your goddamn phone away. Like, there's a... I mean, presumably, they're not asking you to use this thing during the movie itself, I hope.
I think anything that encourages people to use their phones up until the minute the movie starts is dangerous. It's like that thing where I never want to shush people talking during the trailers, because I feel like, you know, you should be allowed to, but it's always the people who are talking loudly during the trailers who talk during the movie. And so it's
you
want to
cut it off before it's
right.
Before
it's
gets
the
bad.
Same thing. It's like if you're using your phone during the trailers, you're going to be the guy, or in leading up to the trailers, you know, that much, you're going to be the person who's using it during the movie. If there's a way to, I don't think Regal would do this; so it'd be too annoying for their patrons. But to like connect what showtime you're seeing, or like geolocate it to the app, so that it shut off when the movie started.
Oh my god,
that would be cool. And then
by downloading the Regal app, you agree to have your phone automatically shut off when your movie starts.
The app. I mean, like the app would become unusable for the 2 hours that the movie was on.
Oh,
so that you couldn't just like stay on it.
But then they would just go back to Snapchat, or
sure, but then I would murder them.
I mean, yeah, it's so complicated that we all had to read the story 3 times, and I'm sure that once you actually have the thing in your hand, it makes more sense, but it does feel like kind of the opposite of the way that a lot of things are moving to making movies more pleasant experiences, which is to focus on the actual experience of being in the theater and not try to add a bunch of crap on top of it.
That
well, it's
is,
a weird, it's a, It's a weird place to put AR. Like, I get that AR is coming for, like, certain sects of the community, but I don't know why moviegoing needs AR. You would think that that would be the one place that you don't need AR is in a movie theater. Like, the whole plan is to go there to have an experience that's, like, not through your phone. So, yeah. Even though I'm have occasionally made the, you know, the devil's advocate argument for, like, seating it for cell phones in the back in the past or whatever, this just seems like a weird muddying of what the movie theater is expected to give you. Like, we live in the part of entertainment culture that is supposed to give people these trailers and contextualize these interviews. Like, I don't know that I need like a movie bill publication that's only available where I don't want it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess on the other hand, if you're someone who is going to go see, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 2 or what's the new one that came out this year? Spider-Man
Homecoming.
Yeah, you're going to go see that one and you haven't been reading IndieWire or Vanity Fair or wherever the hell else we're all working, you like can get all that information there. You can like see the trailer for the first time. I mean, presumably there are people who are going to the movies still who aren't paying attention on that level.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I'm still hung up on your earlier argument, which I think is the most important one, which is that you shouldn't lure people in the theaters with things that distract from the theater experience. I mean, you should make the theater better so that they're more inclined to go there, but there's no point in like giving into the enemy in order to get some of their business. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just hastening the end of the business for short-term gains. That just seems really silly. I think that we need to be leaning more away from the digital world and more, I mean, with ticketing and one thing, reserve seats, I think all that stuff's great, but more into physical comforts in the theater, you know, better lights, better sound, better screens, better projection. Make sure the movies are audible and they don't fuck up halfway through and that people don't talk. And just like, you know, Alamo business obviously is flawed in ways that relate to social ills and not. But I think that they, in general, in terms of the theatrical experience, have the right idea.
Who drew the dicks, Katie?
I haven't finished it, so I don't know.
Well, I don't think the point is to know. Katie Rich was like, I'm watching this thing called American Vandal. I think you guys should check it out. People have been catching on to it. Previous to this, my personal friend Julian and Joanna Robinson, friend of the podcast, had also mentioned that American Vandal was good. But I was like, hey, I'm too busy for all these Netflix series. As we've talked about, there's a lot to watch on Netflix. And then a lot of Netflix is constantly making more stuff. They're going to spend billions of dollars next year making all this stuff. Can't commit to watching it all. So I wait for some canaries to come out of the coal mine. People are like, American Vandal, worth your time. Katie's like, watch a couple episodes. We'll talk about it next week. Watching a couple, two episodes turned into me finishing it all the next day as I realized that American Vandal, the mockumentary about whether or not a student spray-painted 27 penises on 27 cars as he was expelled for before the documentary begins, is actually one of the best shows of the year, regardless of what else airs in the fall season. And it really took me by surprise. I think it was the fact that I didn't have a high expectations of it and maybe that I was dragging my feet getting into it, that I was so surprised to see the show meet me at my expectations for it. I take in a lot of true crime. This is very much modeled after Serial and Making a Murderer specifically with a little bit of Jinx thrown in. So I knew all the beats and what to expect. And every time I thought I knew what the series was doing and trying to communicate to me, it unveiled another layer of what it was trying to do, either satirically or with its actual characters. So these joke characters that start off making penis jokes in episode one actually develop through episode eight, to the point where it's kind of, you kind of start forgetting that they're actors and start investing a little bit in what American Vandal has to say about the American high school experience. So, Katie, Rich, thank you so much for getting me on American Vandal. I had to finish it. Well, but apparently you're still on a hook somewhere.
I'm still six episodes in. I got two more to go. I may watch them after we finish talking. But I think the thing that really convinced me that this is going to work for everybody is that you said Java was totally skeptical and then finished the whole thing.
Yeah, in one sitting. I was like,
that's
just
crazy.
She was like, we were talking about it because I, you know, basically gave an abbreviated version of what I said here, where I'm like, this might be genius. And so she's like, oh, yeah, and we were talking about it, and she wanted me to tell her, like, who I thought did it in the end. I was like, you know, give it an episode or two, and if you don't like it, I'll talk to you about the end. And nope, she just watched it all and was instantly like, that was really good. So American Vandal passed the Java test, which is the first thing to pass both of our tests in a long time.
Man. So you mentioned what you think the show is saying about the American high school experience, which I admit I hadn't thought that much about. I was noticing like the way the characters were developing and the way the narrative stayed surprising, which I think find really impressive. David, I think you've also finished it. Do you feel like you have a grip on like what it's saying beyond just being good?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that it's such an, I mean, I say this as somebody who hasn't been in high school for 14 years now, but, from what I can gather, you're combining what I remember of high school and what I know of internet culture, pop culture, and to a lesser extent, youth culture today. It is so uncannily accurate that, and like so real that, I was almost like, why are we making, you know, more teenage stories? Like, why are we making stories that feel less organic than this? And then I remember that like Lady Bird is one of the very, very best movies of the year, and it's like an entirely different thing, and Edge of 17 last year, and there's room for all of this stuff. But as far as like the veracity goes, and like it's channeling a really juvenile high school sense of humor in a way that still appeals to people who have, I or should have at the very least, grown out of that. I mean, like, I was cackling like an idiot the whole first episode every time they're like, who did the dicks? Like, you know, like, it's like the shit that you think of, like, you know, teenage idiots saying all the time and looking down on and, like, made hilarious to you and, like, reconnecting with what it is about you that always found that stuff funny. It has such a good, clear understanding of high school social dynamics. But really, I mean, what I enjoyed the most about it, beyond the performances, I mean, like, this thing is so brilliantly cast. Jimmy Tatro, who plays Dylan Maxwell, the guy who was accused of doing the dicks, is just so, so good.
Have you seen any of these kids in anything before? Because I've been, like, really enjoying that, like, I mean, Dave, you were saying you forget that they're actors. Like, yeah. I definitely keep forgetting they're actors.
You think that they are, I had never seen any of them as far as I could remember, but it takes a few episodes to recognize that they're actors, you know, to like really get into that groove where you're like, you know, the whole thing is this parody of serial type investigations and making a murder type documentary shows. And it parodies them so precisely, that, and with like such a studied eye that it is easy to at first sort of laugh while also accepting the supposed reality of this whole thing. I think as the drama goes on, it gets a little bit more, involved, you know, it resolves feeling a little bit more like a put on than it started, but the way that it ends is so clever and satisfying and true to the spirit of the shows that it's parodying. I mean, it's like, it's just so complete from head to toe, from like the opening credits, which with like produced by Mr. Baxter, like the whole thing is like it's all in the appearance of a high school television department thing. To the way that they tease out the episodes, the way all these like artificial cliffhangers, the way the narration, I mean, like Sarah Koenig, they understand her way of thinking so well, and the making of her stuff. I mean, it's like Netflix roasting itself in a way. But I found it, because it sort of shows, by virtue of taking the dumbest possible subject and then giving it this treatment, it sort of shows how artificial and how much how artificial so many of the stories are, which is not to say they are false, the serials and the making of murderers, but how much of the drama is engineered rather than found, and how the world is sort of ripe for us all to see every individual story, you know, an incident, no matter how inane or how serious, through this lens, if it's crafted in the right way. And I think that the show is so good because it recognizes how good of a job it's doing at that, and then it moves on to other things around episode 5 or so. And I think the transition there is really impressive as well.
Yeah, Dave, did you say episode 5 was like your fulcrum point too? I remember you tweeting that or saying it at some point.
I would say there's things that happen. Okay, so in episode 4, there's a conversation between the main documentarian team where they're trying to do segments on each other.
Yeah.
That was really the first moment that I realized how this, you know, show could go on for another 4 episodes and still be really compelling.
Yeah.
5 was really good because the documentary begins to have a meta life as kids in school begin to see it. And so they get access to like a crazy amount of social media video of this one party and start recreating the party from social media videos, which I thought was very like clever and more authentic feeling than it should have at the end of it. Because at the end, you're just so tied up with like where a spray can is that you don't realize that you've spent like this hour pivoting off of like where the dicks into like three, or who did the dicks into like 3 other mysteries. And then like, yeah, the last episode, just because of the conclusion that it chooses to have, and when it decides that the story's over, I thought was really smart. And it was, that's the part I think that really opens it up to not only what these documentaries and what the true crime culture does to people, but how that applies to a certain period in everybody's life, every American life at least, where you enter in high school with all these other X factors and you have like no choice but to be making your own true crime documentaries for everybody that you see, and it could go all these different ways. I think they find a way to encapsulate that in a plot and character wise where it's still, you know, the climax is still in a way about the dicks, but the message of the whole series kind of gets recontextualized.
You know what I was? Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. No, go, please.
Oh, I was just thinking about the party episode, which I thought was kind of mind boggling. And it reminded me of Can't Hardly Wait, which is a movie that I love because I was 14 when it came out. But something I've complained about with Stranger Things and a ton of other stuff we talked about is that when they talk about youth or high school, they lean so much on nostalgia. And Lady Bird, a movie that I also love, is part of this too. It's Greta Gerwig making a movie about when she was in high school. But this movie has this like affection and sensitivity toward its characters as if it was being nostalgic for the past, but it's not. It's set in the present day. It's creating its own like sense of time and space within what exists now. And I really I admired that. It's not easy to like take all these kids' Snapchats and make it feel like this cohesive storytelling thing that makes you feel in this world.
Oh, they do such a that's good job with the social media stuff. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's what's amazing about the party episode is the way it's piecing together all these like super stupid videos that have all this information. I mean, it's complicated in addition to being like...
But it also, it's a testament to the fact that we are all, you know, all of us living online now are leaving a constant trail of clues to maybe nothing, but like everything that we do is evidence of some kind. And with so much evidence, I think it's a natural human inclination to look for a crime. And I think that's something that the show does a really good job of. I also think just that they started at such a perfect point. The dicks, as silly as it sounds, are like, become sort of not the perfect crime and that somebody may or may not get away with it, but the perfect crime as a premise for this show, because it's not too serious, but but it's like not too silly because it's grounded in reality. And like it is, I don't know. It's in the way that it's done, and it's also plausible. It never feels like you're being cheated. Like it's not like they are whenever you're like, but what about investigating that guy? I mean, they do it. It's very good.
Do you guys have a... Again, I'm worried about spoiling myself. I just want to talk about our favorite characters, whether or not they did it, because I'm just obsessed with Alex Trimboli, who is like the best, like weaselly kid.
100%.
Like, oh my God, he's amazing. I also like the student council president girl who reminds me of Brie Larson. Krista something or another.
Yeah, she Krista Carlisle.
Yeah.
She is great. Alex Trimboli, who receives a CG recreated hand job in the second episode. it's worth seeing the show for that alone. His hair is really a masterpiece unto itself. I think the guy who plays Dylan Maxwell is just so good. His friends, the Wayback Boys. I mean, like, and everything is so perfectly done. There's this guy, Mr. Kraz, who's like the teacher, who's not like a regular teacher, is a cool teacher who ends up being like a little bit too cool for his own good, maybe. And it's just done to perfection. There's really not a false note in the casting. Everybody looks like they could have been plucked directly from a real high school. Even down to international student Ming.
That was going to be my favorite character.
Ming from Toronto, who has never had a beer before. They do a really good job of teasing out the clues and making you feel smart. I mean, there's a moment involving Ming in the last episode where they give you like a 15-second lead and feeling really smart about figuring something out that is pretty obvious in retrospect. It's all just done. It's a show that feels like it only be made by very stupid people that's done so intelligently that it's just sort of discombobulating.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting when you get done with it, Katie, because I think... No, I can't even say that.
Yeah.
there's an aspect, I think, to the ultimate solution of who did the dicks that when its meta like layer hit me, it made me chuckle. So it's like it's interesting. It's true satire that like we don't actually see that often, in that it manages to so concisely have something to say about not only its like medium but the world it takes place in, but then also it's so comfortable in what it is, it never elevates above the joke. So even though it ends in a way that I'm preaching is all about like the American high school experience, it's not gonna spend, I think, too much time beating you over the head with that, because it's just so swift and precise with what it has to do, and it does it so authentically. Like, part of the reason I feel like this is going to resonate with younger children is I recognize it as beyond me, but it also doesn't read false. It's not a fake messaging service on a ABC show that's like, oh, the killer found them through like lookbook 5.gz. It's more like, oh, this is so much a part of people's lives that when there's a whole bunch of like Instagram text on otherwise crime related videos, it feels like authentic. It doesn't feel like anybody's shooting an Instagram video to show the paint can. It seems like they're shooting something at this party very authentically. I'm kind of in wonder by how that somebody that is probably closer to my age than these kids' age managed to keep all of that visually under control, because I think the actors managed to handle a lot of the authenticity of the characters, but just the fact the movie never tips its hand and never has a shot that isn't explained as to why it could be there is kind of amazing given the long form storytelling it takes.
Yeah, out. I mean, it's something that never would have been possible on network television or even maybe on like a premium cable channel. I mean, they needed a place that was so hands off. They were like, oh, you're going to have kids, like the actors shoot so many of these crucial scenes, and you're really just going to make 8 episodes about dicks. I mean, they had to talk to Netflix and say, you know, we promise it's not going to be just an 8-hour-long dick joke or 4-hour-long dick joke. But there is a feeling like they just let them sort of run free in a way that any other entity would have balked at. And I think we've seen that time and again really pay off for Netflix in a way that they have yet to figure out how to make it pay off for movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this came at a time where I feel like I was feeling kind of burned out on Netflix a lot because of the movies that we're talking about and the huge amount of content they keep throwing our way. But then this and Big Mouth, which I also haven't watched, but it's like similarly like kind of
dick
adolescent.
Themed?
Dick-themed, literally about adolescence.
I watched the first episode of Big Mouth right after watching the first episode of American Vandal, and it was like the dickest night I've ever had in my life.
But I feel like it does say something in Netflix's favor that these two shows are really working for people, and like you were saying, like could never have happened. Like think about like the beginning of like the prestige TV era where everything had to have like a meaning and an anti-hero, and these shows are like dumb but also so satisfying, and it like Netflix is able, has just has the bandwidth to take a gamble on it.
Yeah.
Are you guys interested in seeing a second season?
Only if it's an anthology, I think.
I mean, I think the problem is that we've seen from Serial and the lack of second seasons that other entities produced that these shows don't necessarily lend themselves to second season because they are born from one story, or in this case, parodying one kind of story. I mean, I think that they would have to be a second season of this, and I know that they have seriously talked about having a second season, and they're thinking a lot harder about it than I would have thought, is that it would have to be like a Documentary Now approach, where it would have to do like a long-form mockery of another kind of self-serious nonfiction storytelling. That would be my guess as to what they would have to do.
Yeah, I think there's some true crime stuff they could maybe do. I mean, I think like they could do some more like obviously guilty subject stuff like the Jinx, or maybe like light reenactment stuff with like the Thin Blue Line, but like not as much like American Horror Story season 6 where the reenactors become characters, but maybe not necessarily that. But you're right in the sense that I don't want to give up on these characters, but I think that it has an anthology is probably a better way of going about this. Like not only an anthology, but like do Exit Through the Gift Shop. Don't do like another crime.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sure. I hope Bill Hader and Fred Armisen take this as a compliment and not them just having the more popular documentary parody.
I hope they get in a contest over who could do better documentary parodies, because I would love all of that.
Free market.
Yay, free market.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. Matt Patches will presumably be back after ghosting on us. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
Oh, I'll take Patches' place. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You could find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find my writing at Thrillist.com. We're leading into Stranger Things season. I'm going to be your crazy theory guy over there. And this week on Storm of Spoilers, my other podcast, we are doing a great debates for the greatest horror villain. You could email your thoughts to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. We will make a bracket, and we will come out with the absolute greatest horror movie villain.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich, and at IndieWire. You can find all of us, including Matt Patches, wherever he may
be. Traitor.
On Facebook, at Fighting in the War Room.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com. And I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can hashtag Kraz did it and also answer this week's lightning round question, which is,
in honor of Jigsaw, what was the best film to come out of the millennium resurgence of both splatter horror or reboots?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
2 weeks, no yawn. We're on a roll.